You're leaving a digital trail. What about privacy? Now, this is partly about, social networking, and partly now back to the old privacy thing. And Harrison Brown, an 18-year-old freshman majoring in math at MIT, didn't need to do complex calculations to figure out he liked the deal. In exchange for letting researchers track his every move, he receives a free smartphone. Now when he dials another student, researchers know. When he sends an email or text message, they also know. When he listens to music, they know the song. Every moment he has his Windows mobile smartphone with him, they know where he is and who's nearby. Mr. Brown and about 100 other students living in Random Hall at MIT have agreed to swap their privacy for smartphones that generate digital trails to be beamed to a central computer. Beyond individual actions, the devices capture a moving picture of the dorm's social network. Students' data is but a bubble in the vast sea of digital information being recorded, an ever thicker web of sensors from phones to GPS units, the tags and office ID badges that capture our movements and interactions, coupled with information already gathered from sources like web surfing and credit cards, the data is the basis for an emerging field called collective intelligence. So, offers powerful capabilities for improving the efficiency of advertising, giving community groups new ways to organize. But even its practitioners acknowledge that if misused, collective intelligence tools create an Orwellian future on a level Big Brother could only dream of. And so insurance companies could use behavioral data to identify people suffering from a particular disease and deny them insurance companies. Government or law enforcement could identify members of a protest group by tracking social networks revealed by the new technology. There are so many uses for the technology, from marketing to war fighting, that I can't imagine it not pervading our lives in just the next few years. Most significant technologies. Wireless sensors. Now here's Mark Rottenberg, who's the head of the Electronic Privacy Information Center. Some have argued that with new technology, there's a diminished expectation of privacy, but the opposite may also be true. New techniques may require us to expand our understanding of privacy and to address the impact that data collection has on groups of individuals and not simply a single person. Mr. Brown, for one, isn't concerned about his privacy. The MIT researchers have convinced him that they've gone to great lengths to protect any information generated by the experiment that would reveal his identity. Besides, he says, the way I see it, we all have Facebook pages, we all have email and websites, and blogs is a drop in the bucket in terms of privacy. Google deployed an early warning system for flu trends, location trackers in cell phones, GPS units in cars. We've been through all of that. So I think we talked about sense networks before, maybe not. Wealth of useful information hidden in the digital archive of GPS data generated by tens of thousands of taxi rides in San Francisco. It could see, for example, that people who work in the city's financial district would tend to go to work early when the market was booming, but later when it was down. So that's useful information if you run a taxi fleet. Also notice that middle-income people, as determined by zip code data, tended to order cabs more often just before market downturns. They have two applications, one for consumers and the other for companies. Consumer application identifies entertainment hotspots in a city. So you go to the bars because other people are going there. Connects information on Yelp and Google about nightclubs and music clubs. And the other one is for businesses, gives them insight into human activities. Whole new set of activities we never measured. See people moving around in stores. Such travel patterns coupled with data on incomes can give retailers early insights into sales level and who's shopping at competitive stores. Okay, so you sign up for, GPS tracking. They know where you live, so they know your income. Five-digit zip codes, are very accurate, calibrators of income, at least in the collective level, not necessarily about you individually, but they're really trying to get aggregate data here. And then this is valuable information for retailers. Alex Pentland, professor at the Media Lab, as co-founder of Sense Networks. Face-to-face communication, more important to an organization's work than was generally believed. Productivity improved. So this is they did this in a in a work with Hitachi. Productivity improved by 30% with an incremental increase in face-to-face communication. The results were so promising that Hitachi has established a consulting business that overhauls organizations via researchers' techniques. They tracked their employees around, discovered that the people who were talking to each other face-to-face were more productive, and then thereby they now have a consulting business where they track other people's employees and make them more productive by increasing the number of face-to-face meetings or something like this. Calls this reality mining. Increasingly being created to leverage wireless networks of digital sensors and smartphones. Group of science and political and environmental actors developing participatory sensing networks. I just want to get, this is the last page. I'm sorry to read the whole thing here, but I didn't assign it. How you assess how you're assessing impacting the environment. Okay, so this is Deborah Estrin, who's working on this environmental impact thing. Project faced a host of challenges, but with the accuracy of the tiny sensors and with researchers' abilities to be certain that personal information remains private, she's skeptical about technical efforts to obscure the identity of individual contributors to databases of information collected by network sensors. Attempts to blur the identity of individuals have only a limited capability, she said. The researchers encrypt the data to protect against identifying particular people, but that has limits. Even though we are protecting the information, it's still subject to subpoena and subject to bullying bosses or spouses. Right? You apparently have access to your own information, and somebody can maybe compel you to, you know, disclose it. So this is some kind of activist. Okay, so here's the part that I want to focus on, not to close, and just kind of get your reaction to. Dr. Pentland says there are ways to avoid surveillance society pitfalls. The commercial use of such information, he has proposed a set of principles derived from English common law to guarantee that people have ownership rights to their behavior, have the right to, you know, you have the right to possess your own data, to control the data that's collected about you, and you can destroy, remove, or redeploy the data as you wish. So you may remember from the book the Fair Information Practice Principles. This sounds like those. They haven't actually worked very well in practice. But then he quickly goes on to say, you know, individual privacy rights must also be weighed against the public good, citing the epidemic involving severe acute respiratory syndrome in recent years. He said technology would have helped health officials watch the movement of infected people as it happened. If I could have looked at cell phone records, it would have stopped that morning rather than a couple of weeks earlier. I'm sorry that trumps minute concerns about privacy, if you can stop an epidemic. So this is like, I don't know if I said it here, but you know, in the Google flu prediction thing, you know, if it was smallpox symptoms people were looking at, you wouldn't necessarily think that privacy was the most important consideration. And here's the last part. We sort of say this at one part back in the privacy chapter of the book, but I want to say, some collective intelligence researchers argue that strong concerns about privacy rights are a relatively recent phenomenon. So not only are they maybe not that important, but it's a kind of momentary thing, this notion that privacy is important. The new information tools symbolized by the internet are radically changing the possibility of how we can organize large-scale human efforts, said Tom Malone, director of the MIT Center for Collective Intelligence. For most of human history, people have lived in small tribes where everything they did was known by everyone they knew, Dr. Malone said. In some sense, we're becoming a global village. Privacy may turn out to have been an anomaly. See, there's another thing that's going on here, which is not mentioned here. But the other besides this, you know, privacy versus collective good kind of dynamic, or privacy versus fun, you know, which a lot of our surrender of privacy among young people, you know, really does have to do with finding where the hot night spots are, as the article says. But there's the other dynamic, which is, you know, given the terrorism in the world today, the tension is between, you know, safety and privacy, or security and privacy, right? That, you know, I don't care what they know about me, as long as they use all that information to make sure that nobody blows me up. And, you know, that's certainly the justification for a lot of the sort of big brotherism. But this is more about little brotherism, right? This is about our own surrender of, you know, data. I mean, but that's the paragraph just above here. You know, if you could stop the SARS epidemic 2 weeks earlier, wouldn't you be glad that the data, you know, that the privacy safeguards weren't so high that they prevented the government from knowing?
I think the reason you're wrong about just saying we need to have this common law notion of saying you own your own private information is that often it doesn't matter whether or not you agree to be tracked. A lot of these systems, as long as if enough other people agree to be tracked, it will still have knock-on effects for you. So, for instance, one of the things that he's done, they've tracked people's behavior all around Cambridge and Boston for different groups, and what they found is that there are some groups of people which follow the same sorts of patterns. Like, if you go to this one bar, and follow this other restaurant, you're likely to also go to these other hard-drinking bars versus people who tend to go to church, you end up going to these other completely different sets of stores, all overlapping in the same geographical area. And so long as there are, in this case, enough people who participate in the system to get this kind of information to be gathered, if someone can then monitor you just going about your business, they can categorize you into one of these groups. Whether or not you've agreed to be monitored and participate in the system. So this is just one example of how turning it over to the individual to make its own decision is insufficient, because my decision about whether or not I share my information will impact you, because it enables others to have this collective intelligence to derive more fundamental results about a large population.
Yeah, so I think what you're saying is, you know, by contrast with the remark that Rautenberg made back on the first page, is that it's not clear that a technological solution to this privacy issue is going to be very easy to develop.
Yeah, and Sandy Petland actually was where it said this effectively. He didn't claim to have the solution. And that's kind of what Deborah Estrin sort of alluded to as well.
You know, I don't know what this is, but this last paragraph really, it really bothers me. This notion, you know, that privacy may turn out to have become an anomaly, and because for most of human history, you know, back when we were in the caves, we all knew what our rest of our tribe were doing, and, you know, in a few years we're again going to know what everybody else is doing. And, you know, there was just this period which corresponded, by the way, to like the period of Western Enlightenment and, you know, most of the, you know, the time when all of this stuff about individual rights was developed, all these theories about what the rights of individuals were against the, you know, against the government, all that stuff, you know, all this stuff, you know, you can believe anything you want, you can say anything you want, you know, you can carry a gun, you know, there's all these individual rights. You know, they can't throw you in jail without, you know, paying too much money. That, you know, this is now, you know, particularly American thing. But, you know, this was the product of a whole historical and philosophical development about the sort of sacredness of the individual as an entity and their rights to do what they want, regardless of the social milieu in which they were operating and what the collective wisdom of the government might be about it. And, you know, the notion that, you know, I'm not saying what Malone is saying here isn't true. It may well be true that it used to be everybody lived in small tribes and everybody knew everything about what everybody did. And, you know, and we may be that we're going back there. But it seems that there's something about individuality and personhood and our sort of understanding of, you know, human liberty, frankly, that goes out the window if you say, don't worry about it because, you know, we're just going to be the way we were 3,000 years ago, so it's fine. I mean, maybe being the way we were 3,000 years ago actually isn't fine. I mean, maybe there's something else that goes with it when privacy disappears. And you said part of it, you know, that the sort of privacy gives the individual a defense when they engage in practices that would meet a general social opprobrium and may even be illegal. As so many social behaviors have been illegal on their way to becoming legal in this country. So this is, you know, remember the title of this course is, you know, Life, Liberty, and Happiness After the Digital Explosion. And this is, I mean, you know, Tom Malone's a perfectly nice guy. There's nothing bad. He's not a bad person. I'm not saying that this is any of these people has any ill intent. But you do wonder sometimes whether, you know, what the costs of progress are. It's probably correct to say that privacy is a creation of the city, that there really wasn't privacy until there were cities. I'm not sure that it has so much to do with, I don't know. It's an anthropological question, which I'm not enough of a sociologist for, and I don't think Malone is either, so, you know, I'm not sure what this argument goes.